It's my great pleasure to be here. Today I'm going to talk about three-point functions in N equals 4 super young mules and spin vertex. So first I will give you some motivation. Why do we care about correlation functions and especially three-point functions? We all believe that now N equals 4 super young mules theory in the planar limit is integrable. And in fact, with integrability, now it's in principle possible to compute the anomalous dimension of any operator in this theory, in principle to any loop. And also we have very nice formulation of Wilson loop and scattering amplitudes, even at finite coupling. But compared to these great achievements, the thing we know about correlation function is much less. So it definitely deserves some further investigation. And we believe, and also N equals 4 super young mules is a conformal field theory. And for a conformal field theory, if you know all the two-point function, which is the scaling dimension, and if you know all the three-point functions, which contains the OPE coefficient, then you have the full conformal data. And in principle, you can bootstrap to obtain higher point functions. So this is our motivation of studying three-point functions. And this is my outline. First, I will talk about three-point functions at chi level. And then I will tell the similar story at one loop. So for people who's familiar with like three-loop and four-loop calculation, this might not seem so impressive. But I hope I can tell you why this is difficult and why chi level and one loop is already not so trivial. And in the last 15 to 20 minutes, I'm going to tell you something about our new work in progress, which is a new formulation of three-point functions. We call it the spin vertex formalism. So we start with chi level. In my opinion, computing three-point function is a bit like cooking. So when you cook, there are three important things you need to do. First, you need to prepare the ingredients. And here it means we need to prepare our three operators with definite anomalous dimension. And the second step is you need the recipe to tell you how you put these ingredients together. So here it means we need some way to, some rules to glue the three states together so that we will have a three-point function. And the last step is actually do the cooking, which is here means computation, obviously. So let's keep this analogy in mind, and I will tell you the different stories at chi level and at one loop. So first we start with the ingredients. N equals 4 super young mules has many, many fields, so we can build our operators in many different ways. And the usual way to proceed is we restrict ourselves into some small sectors. And in this talk, I will restrict myself in the so-called SU2 sector. This means we make our three operators in terms of two fields. So for example, this O1 is made of a complex scalar field Z and X. And O2 is made by Z bar and X bar. So, in general, you will have operators like this, some Z, and then X, and Z, and you have other terms. And I want to mention that here, O1 and O2 live in the same SU2 sector, and O3 live in another SU2 sector. And we also want these three guys to have definite anomalous dimension so that a structure constant can be defined. And in order to do this, these guys have to be the eigenstate of one loop dilatation operator. And we know the one loop dilatation operator is in SU2 sector is nothing but the Heisenberg XXX spin chain. So we know how to deal with this guy very easily. And in our case, the three-point function, the form of three-point function is completely fixed by conformal symmetry up to a constant, which is called the structure constant. And this guy can be perturbatively expanded So in this talk, what we will concern is the first guy, the tree level structure constant, and the second guy, which is the one loop structure constant. So as we said before, we can we want to compute the structure constant in terms of spin chain language. So here, for example, we can always imagine that this field Z is some spin up, which is the vacuum, and this X is some spin down, which is the excitation. So then this operator becomes some spin up and spin down and linear combination. So this looks really like the state in a spin chain. And since we want these guys to be the eigenstate of Heisenberg spin chain, and we can build this kind of state by Bethe-Ansatz. And these guys are called beta states. And the beta states are labeled by a set of parameters, which we call rapidities. And these guys actually is the solution of beta equations. So we will have three sets of rapidities. And it's not hard to see that the structure constant will be a function of these three sets of rapidities. And we write it in this way. In the numerator is what we call the cubic vertex. And in the denominator, there are just the norms of these beta states. So now we have the ingredients. So let's talk about how to have a recipe to glue them together. At tree level is really easy because all we need to do is weak contraction. And since we are considering the planar limit, so our weak contraction is subjected to planarity. And due to our very special choice of fields, we start with some xz and x bar z bar. So we will have some two pieces of trivial contractions. By trivial contraction, I mean here, for this part, you contract only z with z bar and nothing else. And this part, you contract only x with x bar and nothing else. And the only non-trivial contraction is this part, where you can contract either x with x bar or z with z bar. And also in this diagram, it's easy to see that it's very natural to somehow cut this spin chain into two pieces. And each of this piece will contract to some other piece in other spin chain. So this is the way of how to glue the three spin chain states together. And then how to compute it? The first method was proposed by Escobedo, Gromov, Severi, and Vieira, and the method is called tailoring. So there are three steps in tailoring. First is called cutting. So as the picture before, it is natural to decompose our spin chain into some sub-spin chains. And this is what cutting is doing. So this means you take your beta state, and then you write it as tensor product of two substates. And each of these guys still takes the same form as beta states. But the problem is now they don't satisfy the beta equations anymore. And in doing this cutting, actually you have to sum over all the possible partitions of this rapidity. So the second step is called flipping. Flipping means you start with you take one of these substates, and you take this state from a cat state, you map it to a bra state. So why do we do this? Because later we want to compute some scalar products. And in order to compute scalar products, you will need some cat state and some bra state. The last step is called sewing. So this means actually you compute these scalar products. So then the final result will be written in this form. And since these guys, after cutting, they do not satisfy beta equations, so the scalar product is some very complicated sum over partitions. And also here, because from cutting, we need to sum over all the possible partitions. So you can imagine that if we have a large number of U, V, and W, here it will be a very huge sum of partitions. And each of these terms is very complicated, and that's why at tree level, this problem is highly non-trivial. So for our case, there is another way, which is simpler. It's called freezing. And this was proposed by Omar Foda. So the idea of the freezing method is we map the Heisenberg spin chain into the six vertex model. And this mapping is well known in condensed matter physics. And then the computation of our cubic vertex is now translated into the computation of some partition functions on this very strange lattice. So then you proceed to do the computation. You find that actually the result is very simple. It's just the product of two scalar products. There is no sum over partitions anymore here. And also here U and the W, we didn't cut it. So these guys still satisfy beta equations. So we will call this kind of states called on shell. And when one of these guys is on shell, the scalar products can be simplified tremendously. So they can be written in terms of a determinant. So here actually is the product of two determinants. Also, in using this freezing method, we have the freedom to introduce some extra parameter called impurities. So you'll start with a spin chain, XXX. Then for each site, you associate it with some impurities. And this guy is still integrable. So these impurities will play a very important role in the higher loop computation. But for tree level, all we need to do is we put these data just to zero. Then we will obtain the tree level result. So using freezing, the final result is written in this way. We have two scalar products, which correspond to the cubic vertex. Then in the denominator, we will have norms. And these guys can come with some thetas. And every one of these guys is a determinant. So actually, all we need to compute is five determinants. And so at tree level, we take thetas to zero, which is the homogeneous limit. So I will show later that for one loop, all you need to do is you fix this thetas, not to zero, but to some very specific value. Then you will obtain mainly the main part of the tree levels. Of the one loop structure constant. So usually after we obtain this result, we would like to take some special limits and to have some object, some meaning, some information from this. And one of the most important limit is the so-called semi-classical limit. So this is the limit where you take the length of the spin chain to be very long. And then you take the number of excitations also to be very large, but you keep their ratio to be a finite number. And why do we care about this limit? Because in this limit, you will have a lot of beta roots, and these beta roots will typically they will condense into cuts. So then you will end up with some nice analytical results. And the most important thing is in this limit, you are able to compare your results from this field theory spin vertex language with the comparison in strong coupling, which is done in string theory. And this kind of limit was first investigated by Pedro and collaborators, and then it's generalized by Kostov and collaborators. So I will show you the final result, which is here. So we still remember that our structure constant is written as five determinants. And here we have five terms. And each term will correspond to one determinant. So here the first two terms correspond to the cubic vertex, which is the product of two determinants. And these three guys, they correspond to the norm, which we divide. And every one of these guys, they take a similar form, which is contour integral of some d-logarithm function. And the most important thing here is that we can see here the structure constant is written in terms of what we call quasi-momentum. So all you need to know here is that quasi-momentum is some simple functions which encodes all the information about your beta state. And this guy is also very important in the study of spectral problem. So here we really see that these two problems now start to connect together. And as I said before, so in order to obtain the tree level result, all we need to do is we put thetas to zero. Then we obtain some simpler result. And the integral contour is by encycling all these beta roots. So these beta roots will condense, and then you encycle all these roots. And this is a nice result for semi-classical limit. Okay, now I've told you about the tree level result. Now we move to one loop. And we will see that at higher loops, there will be some new features. And the ingredients, the recipe will be changed, and the computation will be more difficult. So first, let's talk about how these ingredients are changed. We start with three operators, and we want these guys to have a definite anomalous dimension. So at tree level, we need to do is we need to diagonalize the one loop dilatation operator. And the one loop dilatation operator takes this form, which is the Heisenberg spin chain. And this we know how to diagonalize. The problem is if you go to higher loop, then your dilatation operator becomes more complicated. So they actually becomes long range interacting spin chain. So for example, if you go to one loop higher, you have the two loop dilatation operator, it takes this form. As we can see, apart from the interaction between k and k plus 1, here we have interaction between k and k plus 2. So as you see, the interacting range is increased by 1. And if you go to even higher loops, your interacting range will increase even more. And then the Hamiltonian looks more and more ugly. And the problem about this kind of spin chain is that there's no systematic way to construct eigenstates for these guys. So we see that for preparing the ingredients, we hit a big problem. And then what about how to glue the three states together? We say that at tree level, all you need to do is weak contraction. But if you go to higher loop, you have to take into account quantum corrections. And these quantum corrections will manifest themselves as some loop insertions. And this means that for one loop and the higher loops, so at the point where we cut the spin chains, we actually have to put in some other operators. And the problem about this operator is first we need to know how these operators looks like. So someone have to compute this guy. And the second thing is that we need to actually compute it, how to take into account when you really compute the structure constant. So fortunately for us, at one loop, these insertions, they are computed in the literature. And we know they take the form of Hamiltonian density. But we only know, for the moment, we only know these guys, these insertions in some small sectors at one loop. And we don't know how to, because usually in order to compute this guy, you need to do Feynman diagram computation. So if you go to a bit higher loop, it will be much harder to do Feynman diagram computation. There's one example to show how difficult it is. After we computed this three-point function, we asked an expert in the field whose name is Jan Plevka. We asked him, Jan, is it possible that someone compute a two-loop insertion for us? And he said, well, of course it's possible, but it might take the whole PhD of a student. So it sounds that it costs a lot. So that's why there's another problem, which someone have to give us this loop insertions. And this is very hard to compute. Now we complained about the difficulties. Now let's come to the solutions. So first, how do we construct the eigenstate of BDS spin chain? Now in order to do this, we use a very important observation by this gentleman, Pfizer, Bagheer, and Loyalbert, they found that the BDS spin chain, which is long-range interaction, actually has the same spectrum as the inhomogeneous XX spin chain, which is our guy here. If we put these thetas to this very special value, so this means that if they have the same spectrum, this means these two theories, these two spin chains must be related by some kind of unitary transformation. So we will call this unitary transformation S. And if we know this S, then the problem is simpler because we can start to construct the eigenstate for this guy, which we know how to do exactly. And then we act our unitary transformation on this thing. Then we will obtain the eigenstate of the BDS spin chain. This is the solution. And also this S transformation, they preserve the RTT relation, which is Youngian algebra. So this nice property is called morphism property. So now the problem is, do we know S, the unitary transformation? And the answer is yes. So in general, the S operator looks like this. It can be written as the product of two parts. This part we call the shift part, and this part we call the boost part. And what does this shift part do? This shift part is you start with a spin chain inhomogeneous, and then this shift part will take the impurities from their BDS value back to zero. So in this way, it will translate an inhomogeneous model to a homogeneous model. And then the boost part, what does it do? The boost part will boost a short-range interacting spin chain to a long-range interacting spin chain. So if you think about it, it's really what we want to do because we want to relate two spin chains. On the one hand, it's inhomogeneous but nearest neighboring. On the other hand, it's long-range but homogeneous. So this S operator, at one loop, it takes this form and it does what we want. So in this way, we know how to prepare the ingredients.
Do you know how to do this at finite volume, or do you have problems with boundary terms?
We know how to do it in finite volume. This is a good question, because either this shift part or this boost part, is they have some singularity at the boundary. But somehow, if you put them together, this singularity will kill each other. So then, this S transformation is a well-defined object for the finite volume, and this is the good thing about this S transformation. So in order to take into account this one-loop insertion, we need another tool, which we call the PD relation. It's kind of its permutation and derivative relation. This kind of relation was first appear in the paper by Pedro and Collier. And it should be understood this way. This derivative is the derivative with respect to the impurity. So the way you do it is you introduce impurities for these guys, and then you take derivative, then you put these impurities to zero. So in this way, you can translate the action of this is one minus permutation. So you can translate any permutation in terms of derivatives. And this is very convenient. And we can generalize this kind of relation to higher orders. We can actually generalize to any kind of permutation, but just the derivatives will be more and more involved. And here is very important to realize that the PD relation in the bulk, which is far away from the splitting points, they take us different form from this PD relation at the boundary, which is the point that near the splitting point. And you actually have some other boundary term, which you need to compute. So now we're equipped with these two new tools. We can sit down and do the computation. So I will show you the final result. It's a sum of two terms. So the first term, it looks very familiar because at chi level, we already encountered this guy. And we said before, at chi level, we need to do, we put these thetas to zero. And now this is the BDS part, which comes from the same expression, but you put these thetas to their BDS values. And that's it. And we also have another extra term, which we also computed explicitly, but it just doesn't make sense to write it here. And what's nice about this delta 1, 2, 3 is that in the semi-classical limit, when you take your spin chain to be very large, the correction that comes from the BDS part, compared to this guy, actually this guy is 1 over L suppressed. So this means if you take the spin chain to be very long in the semi-classical limit, actually you can ignore this term. So what we are left is just the BDS part. And this guy, we know how to do the semi-classical limit. We know how to, this is very simple object. So that's kind of nice. So let me discuss the interesting thing, which is the strong-weak comparison. We said before that in semi-classical limits, we can actually compare our result with the computation in string theory. So in the following, I will compare the cubic vertex because the norms are kind of simple. So I will focus on this part. And we will do the comparison in the so-called Frobenius-Zeitlin limit. This is the limit where your coupling constant can be large, but your length of the spin chain is even larger, so that this effective coupling constant is small. And a priori, there is no guarantee that these two guys will match. But anyway, it's fun to do this. So here is the comparison. Above is our computation in using spin chain language and scalar product and so on. And below is the computation done by Kazama and Komatsu. So the first thing I want to emphasize here is that these two computations are done in a very different ways. They use very different technique. But still, they have very similar structure. You see, here still the sum of two contour integral and written in terms of quasi-momentum. Here also, contour integral, quasi-momentum. But there also seem to be some apparent difference, because here the red terms, it seems that at strong coupling we have some two extra terms. And also here, I didn't specify the contour. That is because if you read their 120 pages paper, you'll find that this contour can be quite complicated. So to somehow sum up, what do we have? We have the integrand that when the terms are common, they both have these terms, then the integrand is the same. What's unclear is that there are two extra terms come from strong coupling. And we don't know actually these terms are actually zero or do they have some non-zero contribution. And what's unclear is also can we change the contour in some ways so they are the same. But according to our friend Shota, recently told me that actually they made some more progress, and they can show that these extra two terms, the contour of these two terms, can be shrink to a point. So these guys will actually vanish. And then the contour can be modified in such a way that is the same as weak coupling limit. So this means we actually have a full agreement. And this is some unpublished result. So we pretend we don't know this after this seminar. So I emphasize again, these two computations are done in a very different technique, by a very different technique, but still we get a full agreement. So this means there must be some common integrable structure behind this thing. So this will lead me to the third part of my talk. So in my opinion, of course, when you compute things, you compute at weak coupling, you compute at strong coupling, you can compare numbers. Of course, comparing numbers is very important, but what's much more important is to identify the similar structures between the two parts In this way, we can really understand what's going on. So our motivation is to find a new formulation of the three-point function so that we can see the common structure on both sides. And this is our work in progress. And also, Shota also worked on this in this progress, and we will have collaboration in the future. So our motivation actually starts with the string vertex. Let me tell you a little bit about this. During the year of 2002 to 2005, people are very excited about one degenerate of ADS-CFT correspondence, which is called the BDS correspondence. And in string theory, the BDS string actually is kind of point string moving around the equator. It's a string moving in the PP wave background. So in such a string theory, you can compute the correlation functions by some other technique called Lightcon string field theory. So usually we compute the correlation function of strings by we know the vertex operator and we integrate over the Riemann surface. But here we can use actually a different technique called Lightcon string field theory. And in this technique, the most important thing is to construct some object which is called the string vertex. And this object will contain all the information of how you should glue your three strings together. So here I will explain a little bit. This is the string vertex. And here, A dagger, they are creation operators. They will create some excitation mode for the string. And here, R and S, they label different spins. So R and S is runs from 1 to 3. You have spin 1 to spin 3, string 1 to string 3. And this M and N, they describe the mode number of your excitation. And also here the I, they will describe the polarization of your excitation. And apart from this exponential part, you will have some prefactor, and that's the prefactor is some polynomial in terms of these guys. And here this N tilde, this guy, is called Neumann coefficient. So it's some known function. So as we can see, indeed, this guy will couple the modes from different strings, R and S. So all the information is contained in this guy. Once you are given this string vertex, what you do is you can prepare three string states, which is obtained by acting some creation operators on your vacuum. And then you can act these three guys on it, on this guy. So you will get some number. This is how they compute the three-point function in string field theory. And by BDS correspondence, this guy will correspond to the structure constant in field theory. So this is the idea. And it's a very natural question to wonder, can we actually construct something like this, something that if you map three states on this guy, will give you the structure constant. And such an object, we will call the spin vertex, because we are using the spin chain language. So the idea is, if we can construct it something like this, then we prepare three beta states, and we add these beta states on our string vertex, it will give you automatically the structure constant, the three-point function. And whether this such an object exists. And as I said before, this guy actually tells you how to glue your three states together. So at tree level, it's very simple, because at tree level, the way you glue is just you do weak contraction. So at tree level, it looks like this. This inside the black box is just some wires you connect it together and subject it to planarity. So here we see we have many, many arcs. And each of these arc, this small arc, actually correspond to this one. Because when we do weak contraction, we contract Z with Z bar. And we also contract the X with X bar. So it's natural that this guy will correspond to such an object. And at tree level, all you need to do is to you take many, many tensor products of these arcs. So then you will build the spin vertex. We can have 2-point spin vertex, which actually you can use it to compute a 2-point correlation function. And then you can construct it, the 3-point spin vertex, using pieces of this 2-point spin vertex. And you will obtain this thing. So we show that actually in the BMN limit, we can somehow take the BMN limit of this guy. And then you'll reproduce exactly the same structure as I showed before in the light cone string field theory. We are able to reproduce exactly the Neumann coefficients and exactly the same form. So not only this vertex is this vertex can already be, although it's very simple, but it can already be very useful. In Shota's upcoming papers, he will demonstrate how to use the vertex to compute some correlation functions, which is not so obvious before. So at tree level is already very useful. And also it has very nice property. So let us consider the 2-point vertex. This is an object live in the tensor product of space 1 and space 2. So this means if you send something, if you hit something from the first space on the vertex, it will give you something back in the second space. So and if you send in this symmetry generator, what you will obtain is also the symmetry generator, but maybe in a different representation. And using this kind of reflection property, we can actually prove this very cute identity. So here, this R, they are the R matrix of the Heisenberg spin chain. And so here, 0 is the auxiliary space, and the 1 and 1 bar are the quantum space. So we can show that the action of such two R matrix, and this R matrix, the quantum space in the conjugate representation, we add this thing on the vertex, actually we get back the vertex itself. So this means the vertex is invariant after this action. So we can see this identity from this kind of diagram. So here, at each of these intersecting points correspond to one R matrix. So on the left-hand side, we have the multiplication of two R matrix. And then on the right-hand side, you will have just this. So this means you have the freedom to move this line from the bottom to the top. So this is a very cute identity. What can we do with this? We can take many of these arcs as before, and then we can build our 3-point vertex. Then each of these points, still, they will correspond to some R matrix. And what you got here is you will multiply many, many R matrix. And usually in integrability, the object that obtained by multiplying many R matrices is called the monogamy matrix. And this is the monogamy matrix. And we can use the identity before to prove that this monogamy matrix acting on the 3-point vertex actually is invariant. And the proof is very simple. It can be done in two steps, step one, step two, just by moving lines. So this thing is very interesting. We have monogamy matrix. So usually in integrability, if you expand a monogamy matrix, what you will get is the Youngian generators. So then these Jungian generators will annihilate such a state, such a vertex. So in this sense, our three-point vertex is some kind of Jungian invariance. And this is not, this is very familiar in the amplitude business, because the amplitude, the integrand, is also a kind of Jungian invariant. So in this case, we have something very similar from this. And also, what's more important, what's interesting is that in the semi-classical limit, this guy, our three-point monogamy, is actually the same as the product of three monogamies for the three spin chains. And this kind of equation, M1, M2, and M3 equals 1, is actually the very important input from the strong coupling computation. Because when you read, if you read Kazama and Komatsu's paper, you'll find that this identity actually contains the information how you should glue the three strings together. So this identity, his counterpart, seems to be this guy. So in this sense, we have something really, the similar structure is appearing. At strong coupling, we have that identity because it's in the semi-classical limit. But here in spin chain language, we'll have this identity, which encodes the same information. And all we have done here is at tree level. So our main conjecture, or is a very natural suspicion, is that this kind of stuff, this monogamy condition identity, they should also be true at higher loops. And maybe if we can find some way to deform this guy to higher loop, then we were able to find the correction of this vertex, so that we can really know how to obtain these one loop insertions. Because as I said before, when you go to higher loop, apart from weak contraction, the main part is you have some one loop operator insertion. And these are usually computed by Feynman diagram. So if we can obtain the one loop insertions just by using this kind of relation, which means that the one loop insertion can be determined by integrability, then it will be very nice and very natural. Because usually integrability is a way to avoid, is an art to avoid Feynman diagrams. And still for the moment in three-point function, we still need some input that comes from the computation of Feynman diagram. And this is not very satisfactory. So we hope that in doing this, we can fix the one loop insertions, at least in some sectors. And we already see some hints in this. And we will also work in this direction with Shota. So the outlook is the following. The most urgent and probably we can do in the field in the near future is to try to use integrability, the monogamy condition, to fix the insertions. And then it will be very interesting to find the relation between correlation functions and the scattering amplitudes, especially the Jungian invariance. Because I heard that in the amplitude business, there is some way to deform the Jungian invariance and use it at higher loops. So you will get some recursion equations, like Q-bar equations. And maybe this will also appear for three-point functions. Because usually if you have a symmetry, this symmetry will usually lead to some equations. For example, conformal symmetry will lead to conformal world identities. And if you have some more symmetry like integrability, maybe there will be some equations that we can write down for three-point functions. And this might help to determine three-point function at higher loop. And also, the ultimate goal, of course, is to find some all-loop formalism based on the same structure of weak coupling and strong coupling. So, and thank you for your attention.
Can you fix the insertion using this one loop
idea? We're doing that, but we have some hints, but not completely. We have to do it more carefully.
What are the hints?
The hints is the following. We can use this thing to compute the three-point function instead of the structure constant, and then you will insert something which contains x and y. Then here is the vertex, and now here you use your
What is this u square?
U square is some. Okay, so I should write it more carefully. Maybe it's u1, u2, u3. So this u is some transformation of the conformal algebra. Because if you want to retrieve from here, we can represent everything in terms of oscillators. And if you want to retrieve the three-point function, you need to put in these u's, then you will get the correct space-time dependence. Because this will relate, this is actually a rotation in the 0, 5 dimension. So in this way, you can relate the oscillator representation to the real conformal representation, the representation of local operators. So, but this is not, the hint is that we want to obtain from here, because this guy should contain all the symmetry of the theory. So we want to obtain from here the world identity, the conformal world identity. So what we do is we expand this. Then you will have some shift plus u, h1, 2, 3. And this is more or less Hamiltonian 1, Hamiltonian 2, Hamiltonian 3, minus insertion. These are the Hamiltonian densities at the splitting point. So then if you move these guys from the left to the right, you will get something which is very much like the conformal world identity. And you are left with this thing. So what we want to do is to set up a clear logic to extract the structure constant from the correlation function and to try to interpret this guy as the real insertions. So it's not crystal clear for the moment. So this is all I can tell now.
I mean, at one loop, the only invariant tensors that you can insert are the identity and the permutation.
Mm-hmm.
You agree? So by definition, you know that whatever you insert is a combination of identity and permutation, because those are the only invariant tensors of the theory. Shifting by the identity means you're just multiplying the three-point function by a number. You can never fix it by symmetry. And the overall constant multiplying the permutation is the definition of the coupling. So how could this argument ever work?
It's not clear now. So we say we are trying. So maybe we need to really deform the vertex at higher loops, so to see this appear.
Other question? If not, let's thank Kirk again.